You're listening to DTFHN for July 20th, 2026. I'm your warranty voiding host, Jack Haxman. We are your daily tech feed for Hacker News, a website where people who build things argue with people who critique things. Today's got that stubborn builder energy, the kind that looks at a price tag and takes it personally. Let's get into it. $25. That's the API cost. A security researcher named Sean took the prompt OpenAI published for solving the cycle double cover conjecture. A famous open problem in mathematics. And adapted it for vulnerability research. He pointed it at WordPress source code, told it to use four agents for at least 6 hours, and walked away. What came back was a pre-authent test remote code execution chain, the kind of bug exploit brokers pay $500,000 for. The detail worth pausing on is the prompt itself. It wasn't some exotic jailbreak. It was a research methodology prompt, one that OpenAI published openly. Designed to manage multiple agents pursuing diverse strategies simultaneously. Launch a portfolio of approaches. Don't let one dominate. Cross-pollinate only after independent exploration. Use adversarial agents to double-check findings. Keep going when early rounds fail. This is just good research practice. Formalize into instructions a model can follow. And the bug it found. String concatenation. SQL injection. In 2026, in the most deployed CMS on the planet, the kind of vulnerability that shouldn't exist anymore. Hiding in code that millions of sites run in production. The model found it not through some novel AI-native technique, but through patient, systematic code analysis. The same work a skilled human researcher would do, just compress from weeks into hours. Run this forward. The prompt is public. The model is commercially available. The methodology generalizes to any large code base. Today, it costs $25 to audit WordPress. Next year, with cheaper inference and better models, it costs $5. The year after that, it's a background process. Every open source project on Earth gets continuous automated security review. Not from a funded security team, but from anyone with an API key and curiosity. This is what matters about this story. The same capability that found the bug is the capability that will find the next 1,000 bugs across every code base that matters. And because the tools are commercially available, not locked inside a government lab or a defense contractor, the defenders get access at the same time the attackers do. One commenter called it scary. It is. But a world where critical vulnerabilities in software running 500 million websites sit undiscovered for years. That's scarier. The calculus has changed. The cost of finding these bugs just collapsed. And that collapse favors anyone willing to look. We talked about collapsing costs earlier. Pause. Here's someone who took that principle and absolutely ran with it. One commenter put it perfectly. There are many opportunities to retrofit old systems of all types with modern low-cost embedded technologies. That's the quiet thesis underneath this entire project. And the Hacker News thread lit up around it. Here's the story. An SRE. A site reliability engineer. Bought an abandoned 8-lane bowling center in rural Missouri for $105,000. The whole facility. The town had nothing for families to do. A recreation desert. And this person decided to fix that. But the scoring system, the screens, the pin detection, the ball speed tracking, the animations, was installed in 2008, cost six figures, and replacing it would run $80,000 to $120,000 for a system that, at its core, actuates a single relay to trigger a 70-year-old mechanical pin setter. Everything else is software and sensors. So they built their own ESP32 microcontrollers wired to relays, optocouplers, and infrared breakbeam sensors. Running an ESPNow star topology mesh, each node emits sensor events and accepts commands, reporting to a gateway connected to a Raspberry Pi over UART. From there, it's Redis in a state machine. Event streaming into familiar middleware. React, WebSockets, Pub, Sub. Total cost, about $200 per lane pair. $1,600 for the whole center, against a six-figure vendor quote. This has a direct historical parallel. While 1976, the Altair $8,800 cost under $400. The many computers it functionally replaced. These APDP Baza Data Generanovas ran tens of thousands. The capability gap between them was real, but the Altair didn't need to match a Nova feature for feature. It needed to be good enough, cheap enough, and open enough that a community could build on it. That's exactly what happened, and it changed everything. Open Lane Link.
That's what they're calling it.
Follows the same logic. The engineering here deserves real admiration. RS485 sits underneath the wireless mesh as a wired fallback for noisy RF environments. Spare controllers sit pre-flashed in a drawer. A lane swap takes 10 minutes. The entire stack runs on commodity hardware, which means the owner controls their own data, their own theming, their own feature roadmap. Want Tron Night with neon animations? Write some React. One commenter is already talking about DMX, light control, and LED strips that chase the ball down the lane. The plan is to open source the hardware, firmware, and software stack. Every bowling alley struggling with vendor lock-in and $4,000 replacement parts gets access to the same architecture. The tools exist. The components cost pennies on the dollar. And when the blueprints are public, a community of builders can push it further than any single vendor ever would. This is how open source wins.
Not in server rooms and cloud infrastructure, but in an 8-lane bowling center in the rural Midwest, where someone looked at a 6-figure invoice and said, "I can build this better." 3 stories in, we're seeing a pattern today. People refusing to accept that hardware they own isn't really theirs. Next up, moonshine. What does it actually mean to own your hardware? You bop the GPU. You pay for the electricity. The silicon is sitting in your house. But for years, if you wanted to stream a game from that machine to your phone or your tablet or your TV in another room, you needed NVIDIA's permission. GameStream was proprietary. It worked only with NVIDIA cards, only with NVIDIA's software, only on NVIDIA's terms. And then NVIDIA killed it, just turned it off. Your hardware, their switch. The open source community responded the way it always does. Sunshine and Moonlight emerged as open replacements, and they work beautifully. One commenter described streaming upscaled PS2 games from a desktop to a 7-year-old Android box, smooth as silk. Another connects a DualSense controller to a MacBook, launches Moonlight, and plays AAA Steam games on their gaming desktop across the house. The protocol is proven. The ecosystem is thriving. Now here comes Moonshine, and the architecture is worth admiring. Written in Rust, Moonshine re-implements the streaming server with a design choice that reveals real engineering thought. Every streaming session runs inside its own Wayland compositor, completely isolated from your desktop environment. Your host machine stays usable. You can be working on one screen while someone streams a game from your GPU on another device. No dummy HDMI plugs. No monitor at all, actually. It runs headless on a server in a closet, encoding video through Vulkan directly on the GPU H264, H265. Experimental AV1 HDR at 10 bits. Surround sound at 7.1 with Opus encoding. The compositor per session architecture is the kind of decision that separates a re-implementation from a rethinking. It means your streaming server isn't fighting your desktop for control of the display pipeline. It means multiple simultaneous streams become a natural extension of the design rather than a hack bolted on later. The creator describes it as building from scratch with a different set of trade-offs. And those trade-offs are visible in every layer. Pull the lens back and you see the full arc. NVIDIA built a proprietary streaming protocol tied to their hardware. The community reverse engineered it into open standards. Multiple implementations now compete on merit. Sunshine, Apollo, Moonshine. Each pushing different architectural ideas while speaking the same protocol. The client ecosystem, Moonlight, connects to any of them. This is what happens when a protocol escapes corporate control. Innovation multiplies. A single deprecated product becomes a thriving ecosystem of alternatives. Each one built by people who looked at their own hardware and decided that ownership means something. What happens when you unseal something that's been closed for thousands of years? Turns out, Egypt just gave us a stunning answer. Let's be honest about what archaeology actually is. You take a space that someone sealed 3,000 years ago with the explicit intention that it remain undisturbed forever, and you open it. You photograph the walls. You catalog the contents. You publish papers. One of the commenters on this story asked the blunt version, "Isn't desecrating anyone's tomb morally wrong?" And that deserves a real answer, not a hand wave. The case for leaving tombs sealed is coherent. These were built as eternal houses. The dead had specific theological expectations about what would happen to their remains. Every culture has burial taboos, and we don't get to exempt ourselves from respecting them just because the culture in question no longer exists to object. That's the strongest version of the argument. Qsware Collapses, a Dutch team from Leiden University working with Egypt's Ministry of Tourism and Antiquities, has uncovered a Ramesside period tomb belonging to someone named Paser, likely a high official or priest from the 19th or 20th dynasty. The tomb follows the classic New Kingdom pattern. Open courtyard, rock-cut chapel in an inverted T, underground burial chambers. The walls are covered in paintings and hieroglyphic inscriptions that have been sealed from light and air for over 3 millennia. The question nobody wants to ask plainly is this: who owns human history? Because right now, the answer depends entirely on which institution controls physical access to the site. The Leiden team has been working Sheikh Abd al-Qunna since 2018. Their stated goals include preventive conservation and the first comprehensive archaeological study of the area. That's admirable. But comprehensive study that lives in university databases and journal paywalls is just another sealed tomb with extra steps. The Egyptian government frames this as strengthening their position as a cultural destination. The university frames it as systematic knowledge generation. Both are true. Neither addresses whether the actual documentation, the high-resolution scans, the epigraphic data, the stratigraphic records, will be openly accessible to anyone with an internet connection and curiosity. Peza spent his career serving temples and royal administration. His tomb was built to preserve knowledge across millennia. It worked. The paintings survived. The inscription survived. The architectural canon survived. The real question is whether the people documenting this discovery will match that ambition. Not in preservation, but in access. Open the data the way they opened the tomb. Let 1,000 researchers pull the thread. Knowledge preservation across millennia is one challenge. But what about optimizing how fast we can teach machines right now? Fine-tuning a language model is one of those things that sounds like it should be a solved problem. You pick a base model, you pick a data set, you apply LoRa, you wait. But how long should you wait? Nobody actually knows. Every paper reporting LoRa results uses different hardware, different models, different data splits, different metrics. The numbers are incomparable. You cannot look at two LoRa papers and say which technique is faster, because they never ran on the same track. This project fixes that by doing something almost comically simple. One model, one dataset, one GPU, one accuracy bar, a wall clock. Go. The constraint is a single L40S running Qwen 2.5 at 1.5 billion parameters on GSM 8K math problems. You need to hit 57% exact match accuracy. Everything else is yours to play with. LoRa rank, quantization strategy, learning rate schedule, sequence packing, data selection, custom kernels. If you can clear the bar training on 1,000 carefully chosen examples in 90 seconds, that counts. The leaderboard measures wall clock time, period. The baseline takes about 12 minutes. The current record is 6 minutes and 5 seconds. Achieved through sequence packing and completion only loss masking. That is a 2x speedup from one architectural insight about how to structure the training data. And this is exactly the kind of discovery this format is designed to service. The model here is the NanoGPT speedrun, which produced Muno, a real optimizer that emerged from competitive pressure on a fixed benchmark. When you freeze the task and the hardware, the only variable left is ingenuity. The LoRa technique space has exploded in the last 2 years. Dora, Roro, Pisa, LoRa, Plus, Neptune, Rank Adaptive Methods, Unsloth Kernels. All of them claim improvements. None of them have raced each other under identical conditions until now. One of the commenters nailed it. The value is in going smaller, in limiting resources. The default approach in this industry is to turn the knob marked compute until the problem goes away. That is a procurement strategy, not engineering. Real engineering happens at the constraint boundary, where you cannot buy your way out and have to think your way through. The entire stack is open. The harness runs on Modal's free tier. Every record gets independently verified 3 times with fresh seeds. Anyone can reproduce any result with a single command. This is how open source produces science. Not by publishing papers, but by publishing tracks where ideas have to prove themselves against each other in public on identical hardware with receipts. Now, completely different energy, from reproducible AI benchmarks down to the bare metal, pause, eliminating bounds checks in Go with unsafe. A single comparison instruction and a conditional jump, that is the entire cost of a bounds check in Go. 2 instructions, and yet eliminating them is one of the highest yield optimizations you can make on a hot path. The math seems wrong until you think about what those 2 instructions actually do to a CPU pipeline. Every bounds check is a branch. Every branch is a prediction the processor has to make. Every misprediction flushes the pipeline. But it goes deeper than that. Those extra instructions occupy space in the L1 instruction cache. They consume entries in the micro-op cache. They add register pressure, a function that was a lean mean leaf function. No stack frame, no call overhead. Suddenly acquires a call to runtime.panic bounds, which means it needs a frame pointer, a stack save, the whole prologue. Two instructions metastasize into six. A developer named Andre lays out the hierarchy of removal. The conventional approach is elegant. You prove to the compiler that your accesses are safe by touching the upper bound first. Slice your array to the limit before the loop, and the compiler thinks, okay, every index below this is guaranteed valid. Checks removed. Each Go release gets smarter about recognizing these patterns. But there is a ceiling, some access pattern. Strided loops, interleaved wreaths across multiple slices. Defeat the compiler's proof engine. It cannot reason about them. This is where unsafe pointer arithmetic enters. You take the base pointer of your slice, add an offset, and dereference. The compiler generates exactly the load instruction you wanted because there is nothing left to check. You have stepped outside the type system entirely. The trade-off is real, and Andre is honest about it. You are now responsible for correctness. The runtime will not save you from reading garbage memory or corrupting your heap. One commenter asks the right question. Before reaching for unsafe, shouldn't you profile with the compiler flag that disables bounds checks globally, just to see if elimination even matters for your workload? Yes. Absolutely. Measure the ceiling before you build the ladder. But the deeper lesson is about language design. Go chose safety as the default and gave you a clearly marked escape hatch called unsafe. The name is the documentation. Every import of that package is a searchable declaration that says a human verified this. That is the right architecture. Safe by default. Opt-in danger with a paper trail. The tools exist. The proof obligation is yours. Moving on. Every complex system I've worked on eventually hits the same wall. You can redesign the core, or you can make the periphery smarter. Redesigning the core is elegant. Making the periphery smarter actually ships. That's the calculation behind Nivalis Energy's powered trailer kit, now in commercial road testing in Germany. Instead of replacing a diesel tractor with a battery electric truck that costs a fortune, and needs charging infrastructure that doesn't exist yet, they retrofit the trailer. An electric axle rated at 50 kilowatts peak, a 60 kilowatt hour battery. Solar panels on the roof generating up to 3.7 kilowatts. Regenerative braking captures energy on deceleration. Grid charging happens during loading stops the truck was already making. The driver sees a small display in the side mirror. Nothing else changes. Same licensing, same handling, same trailer. The projected numbers are specific. 7,000 liters of diesel saved for trailer per year. 19 tons of CO2, that's based on 100,000 kilometers annually at near full payload, which is a high utilization scenario. And they're transparent about that constraint. Roughly a third of savings come from regenerative braking. About 12% from solar, and the rest from grid charging during stops. Trailer Dynamics. A competitor out of Aachen is reporting 40% fuel savings with larger battery configurations, up to 551 kilowatt hours. They frame the choice correctly. It's not about battery size. It's about the economics of each fleet's actual routes. The architecture here is what matters. A retrofit kit turns every existing trailer into a candidate for electrification without waiting for new truck purchases, without waiting for charging networks to reach every corridor, without scrapping functional equipment. One commenter nailed it. even a version with just solar and regenerative braking, no grid charging at all, with a smaller battery, looks like a good deal. Another pointed out that self-powered trailers could be repositioned in logistics yards by remote control while tractors immediately pick up the next load. That's an efficiency gain nobody designed for, emerging from the capability itself. The pilot is one trailer, one operator, 1 year. The retrofit cost is undisclosed, but the underlying math is public. The assumptions are stated, and the field data is accumulating. This is how industrial decarbonization actually happens. Not breakthrough announcements. Bolt-on kits. Incremental gains. Transparent data. The boring way that works.
What happens when you apply that same bolt-on and improved philosophy to the web browser? Coggy's Orion is finding out. In 1995, Opera Software shipped a browser out of Oslo that almost nobody used but almost everybody respected. It pioneered tabs, mouse gestures, built-in mail, speed dial, features that took the dominant browsers a decade to copy. Opera never won the market, but it proved that a small team with strong opinions about how browsing should feel could push the entire ecosystem forward just by existing. Coggy's Orion browsers play in a similar hand. The Linux beta just landed, and the pitch is straightforward. WebKit rendering engine, zero telemetry, built-in ad blocking, nested vertical tabs. No extensions required for the two things that keep power users tethered to Firefox. Content blocking and tab management. It ships those as first-class features. Now, the criticism writes itself. It's a WebKit wrapper. It's not Lady Bird. It's not Servo. It's not a new engine. And that's true. But there's a concept in Lou theory. The art of building stringed instruments called voicing. Two guitars built from identical wood, identical bracing patterns, can sound completely different based on how the builder shaves fractions of a millimeter from the internal struts. The wood is the same. The instrument is not. WebKit is the wood. What you build around it. The telemetry decisions, the tab architecture, the extension compatibility layer. The philosophical commitment to not watching your user. That's a voicing. The comments reveal the tension honestly. Some users find it unpolished, especially on mobile. UI bugs accumulate. One commenter regrets a $270 lifetime purchase they stopped using. Another raises concerns about Coggy's financial connections to Yandex. These are legitimate friction points, and they matter. But the core proposition deserves attention, a browser that treats privacy as architecture rather than marketing, built-in capabilities that eliminate the extension treadmill, a team that chose WebKit not because they couldn't build an engine, but because the voicing. The decisions layered on top is where user agency actually lives. The browser market is a monoculture slowly consolidating around Chromium. Every serious alternative, even an imperfect one, is load-bearing. Orion doesn't need to win. It needs to exist. That's how ecosystems stay healthy. Diversity isn't a luxury. It's infrastructure. So what happens when someone stops waiting for the perfect product to exist and just builds the hardware themselves? 25 unique components. That is the entire bill of materials for the Jamcorder. A MIDI recorder that sits on your piano and captures everything you play without you lifting a finger. One PCB, one screw, one injection molded shell with generous draft angles and no slides. Chip Weinberger shipped 2,500 of these, and the hardware side gave him almost no trouble at all. Now, the obvious counterargument writes itself. 25 components is a toy. Real hardware means thermal management, RF compliance, multi-board stack-ups. Components with 18-month lead times from a single fab in Shenzhen.
The comments said exactly this. One reader compared it to someone summiting a local hill and declaring that mountaineering isn't so bad. But here is where that argument quietly falls apart. Weinberger's claim isn't that hardware is easy in the abstract. His claim is that hardware is as hard as you make it, and the engineering discipline required to keep a product at 25 components. That is the hard part most people skip. He cut low battery detection, ambient light sensing, the power button, even USB-C. Every one of those cuts is a fight against the instinct to add just one more feature. That restraint is a design skill, and it is arguably harder than solving the complexity you chose not to create. The real weight was where you would expect it from a software engineer building Atoms for the first time. 200,000 lines of code across firmware, a companion app, and manufacturing tooling. 3 years of long nights, pre-LLM. The ratio is striking. Years of software, goon weeks of hardware. And it tells you something about where actual complexity lives when the physical design is disciplined. What Weinberger built is a lesson in scope as engineering. He hand-assembled the first 500 units in 4 days and changed nothing. That sentence should stop you. 4 days, zero revisions. That does not happen by accident. It happens because every decision upstream was made to prevent downstream surprises. The craft here is not in what he built. It is in everything he chose not to build. Disciplined engineering at Deskel is impressive. Pause now, let's talk about what happens when that same rigger walks on four legs. One commenter coined a term that deserves to stick, slop fold. When the robot folds your laundry but it comes out wrinkly and a little off and you accept it anyway because the alternative was doing it yourself. That word captures something important about where consumer robotics actually is right now. And why it might not matter. Chima just dropped a foundation model for robotic manipulation and the comments split into two camps that rarely talk to each other. Camp 1 is grinning because a robot is finally folding shirts. Camp 2 is pointing out that the shirts look like they were folded during a mild earthquake. Both are correct, and only one of them is thinking clearly about trajectory. The technical approach is worth pulling apart. Jamai built what they call an embodiment-free data pipeline. They collected manipulation footage from a universal interface that is not locked to any specific robot body. A vision language model watches clips, describes what happened, and that becomes training data. The pre-training scales cleanly. More data, bigger model, lower error. That curve is the whole story. If you have seen what scaling laws did to language models between 2020 and 2024, you know what a clean scaling curve means for the next 3 years of robotic manipulation. Run this forward. A slop fold today is a crisp fold in 18 months and a reorganized closet in 36. The commenter dreaming about home assistant coordinating a vacuum and a folding robot and an inventory system while they are at work. That is not science fiction. That is an integration problem. And integration problems get solved by bored engineers on weekends. What catches my eye is another comment. The one about designing non-humanoid robots. Someone noted that a third aren't. Maybe a tentacle grip? Would make most tasks easier. They are right, and it points to something Xiaomi seems to understand. The embodiment-free approach means the intelligence transfers across body plans. You train the brain once. You put it in whatever chassis the task demands. That is how open research compounds. One foundation, 1,000 machines. The slop fold is just the beginning. This has been your daily tech feed for Hacker News for July 20th, 2026. This podcast is entirely AI generated. Scripts by Claude Sonnet 4.7. Voice by Quen 3, TTS. Not affiliated with Hacker News or Y Combinator. Now go build something that makes someone say, "That's impossible." We'll see you back here tomorrow.